Recording on.
All right, so today is June 1st, and we're continuing our discussion on the Desiderata Extinctionati, and we're joined once again, our second interview with Derek Jensen. Hugh, do you have any questions that you want to start off, or do you want to continue from last week?
Well, let's continue from last time, but in the meantime, I wanted to ask about the reception that the book and the movie have got, because we've had a little time since we last spoke to you. So, Derek, do you just want to let us know what's happened and how people are taking it?
Well, it has gotten essentially no mainstream reviews, which has been true for almost all my work. And the individual reviews, you know, I, like everybody else, despise Amazon as having destroyed bookstores everywhere. But nonetheless, it's gotten a lot of positive reviews from readers on Amazon. And various individuals have written to me to say they like it. And, you know, it's selling okay for a small publisher book. So it's doing fine, but part of the reason that I'm hesitating is because the first thing I ever had published back in 1983 or something was an interview, and I asked the publisher of the magazine if they'd heard any responses, and they laughed and said, there are two ways to not find out what people think about your writing. One is to not get published, and the other is to get published. And the point is that You never hear a lot. You know, you'll get a few notes from people who really like it and a few notes from people who really hate it. But I think, but that's about it. So I don't know. I think it's doing well, and the people I care about like it.
Yeah, I certainly liked it. It's very powerful. I mean, I'm completely in your camp and a bit of a doomer, but it depressed me reading it because it's so, I mean, I know a lot of the things already that you're saying. Some things I didn't know, like one of the things was wind farms actually create more local heating than they do cooling, which was a new one on me. But I've known generally, I've kind of tracked through the same path, I think, that in most of the material in the book. But presented all in one go like that, it's really an assault. It just highlights where we've got to and how deep the problem is. Go ahead.
I get that response to my work a lot, and I've gotten it ever since the beginning, and I respect it, and there's a part of me that doesn't really understand it because, I guess I can understand it. Here's how I don't understand it and then how I understand it. The way I don't understand it is, you know, it's not really cognitively difficult. It's, you know, we all know that solar panels come from somewhere and that they're made out of something, and that something was probably mined, and the mines caused damage. And so for me, when I'm surrounded by a bunch of lies, it feels, when I read something that's true, it's like, oh, this is such a gift. And I actually feel much better. So that's how I don't really understand the depressing part. The way I do understand the depressing part is, you know, I know how bad things are going in the oceans, I know how bad things are going in the rivers, I know how bad things are going for insects. But that doesn't alter the fact that when I read an account of exactly how bad they are, it is a slap in the face. And it's like, yeah, that's I knew it was bad, I just didn't know it was this bad. And that is depressing. And then the other way I can really understand it is, you know, I don't know if I said last time, but I really believe, I mean, yes, I know, especially when talking to sort of alternative types that we always have to put in a caveat about. There are problems in the Western medical model. Yeah, I agree. So that caveat aside, I like the model. As a doctor friend of mine says, that the proper diagnosis is the first step toward correct treatment. And that said, when a doctor came in to diagnose me, to tell me that I had Crohn's disease when I was 24, it depressed the hell out of me. You know, it's just like, yes, I want to know so that we can make our way forward, but I didn't want to know that. And so there's a sense in which I don't understand the, oh my gosh, your work is so depressing. And then there's a sense in which I do understand the when people find it depressing.
Yeah, but it seems to me it's a behavioral problem. So you've got to look at it more like an addiction, like alcoholism.
Right.
So it's not quite the same as being diagnosed with Crohn's disease, because that's really something that's out of your control. What makes it difficult is that we are all living a lie. I mean, everybody has to live a bit of a lie just to get through the day in our society. So we all culpable of being in denial of our alcoholism. And so it's much more difficult for an alcoholic to admit that they have a chronic disease that they've caused themselves. And then it's very easy to say, no, I don't have a problem. My liver will get better, or whatever the diagnosis is. So it's the culpability that makes it difficult to stare it in the face, because you're really rubbing people's noses in it, saying, you know, I'm the same as you, that I like the truth, but I've noticed that people don't like the truth. And I don't find many people that like the truth. People are all looking for ways to bolster their lies.
I completely agree with you, and I really like that analysis you just made. And one of the responses that I have gotten to the book that has kind of annoyed me is I've gotten a few notes from people saying, and they say this about all my books, why don't you provide any solutions? And we have a chapter called Solutions. And the problem is, we provide solutions, it's just they don't like them. And I don't mind the fact that they don't like the solutions, but I wish they would at least tell the truth about that and say, I didn't like your solutions, as opposed to saying we didn't even provide them. And where this ties into the alcoholic thing is, you can have a bunch of people provide solutions to the alcoholic, okay, like one of them might be stop drinking, and they're like, well, you're not providing me any solutions. So the truth is, and I wrote a note to a guy just a couple days ago who had sent me a note saying that we didn't provide any solutions, and even the solutions we did provide, he put them in scare quotes, calling them solutions, and I said exactly what I just said to you, and I said the problem is that people don't like the solutions because the solutions prioritize life on the planet rather than the economic system. And that makes it, you know, it's worse than them just ignoring it. It's, you know, R.D. Lang came up with the three rules of a dysfunctional family, and rule A is don't. Which is, well, we'll go through all of them. Rule A is don't. Rule A1 is rule A does not exist, and rule A2 is never discuss the existence of rules A, A1, or A2. So in a family that's alcoholic, rule A is don't discuss the alcoholism. You can talk about anything else in the world except for that. And then rule A1 is there is no rule against talking about alcoholism. It's just you don't. Same with abuse, same with any of that. And then there's this other thing that's really interesting to me. And stop me if I talked about this last time. I just love this. This guy in the 60s, Lester Laborsky, did this experiment where he attached electrodes to people's eyeballs, and he would track where they would look. And, I mean, they did this on purpose. It wasn't like he attached it to random people's eyeballs. Anyway, then he would show them a picture or an article or something. And what he found is that if it contained something the person found morally objectionable, their eyes would not even track to it once, which means they saw it in the corner of their eyes and they knew where not to look. And there's a great example I happened to read. At the same time I read about Lester Laborsky in the early 2000s, there was an article I happened to see in the newspaper about some U.S. drug enforcement agency guy in Colombia whose wife was arrested for smuggling cocaine in the United States. And their story, which I believe, was that she had been doing lines of coke in front of him and he would walk through the room and not see it. And now if we think about this with our own lives, you know, I don't know if I'm the only person who's ever been in a really bad relationship, but in this relationship, if somebody said to me, hey, this is, you know, there are problems in your relationship, I would respond, why are you trying to ruin my perfect relationship? And then after the thing's over, it's like, oh my God, how do they not see that? And so my point is that I think the people who complain that there are no solutions in my work aren't actually lying. I think that they are just simply not perceiving them. Or if they do perceive it at all, it's like, well, that's completely unrealistic. And the solutions, just for people who haven't read the book, are things like restoring prairies, restoring forests. You know, a line that I've said for many years is, when people ask, how can we save the salmon? That's not really what they're asking. What they're asking is, how can we save the salmon without stopping industrial logging, without stopping industrial fishing, without taking out dams, without stopping the murder of the oceans, and without stopping global warming? And the answer is you can't. And it's the same here. I want to say two more things. It's the same here with global warming, that how can we stop global warming without fundamentally altering our relationship with the planet? And you can't. How can we stop global warming yet continue to have this blowout party? And then one of the things I didn't say to the guy in the note the other day, but I was thinking about, and I thought about this a lot, is imagine you have one person in a neighborhood or one family in a neighborhood who makes their living by stealing from everybody else in the neighborhood. And at some point, everybody else in the neighborhood gets sick of this and they say to the person, stop stealing from us. And the person's like, how am I going to buy a new car if I'm not taking from you? That's not a realistic solution. And it's the same. You know, we've been committing, perpetrating, whatever word you want to use, drawdown for a long time. And the entire wave of life is based on drawdown. So any solution that stops drawdown will not be acceptable to most people. Because they're addicted, exactly what you said.
Yeah, people want the methadone. They don't want to kick the habit. They want something other than going cold turkey that, you know, as a substitute for that really keeps the habit going. But yeah, I think the thing is that it just depends on how far gone you think the situation is. Because at some stage, I think everybody's on some kind of spectrum of realizing how bad the ecological situation on the planet is. And if you kind of depress, then you can see it a lot easier. If you just got promoted in your job and you're making lots of money and you just bought a yacht, it's really, really difficult for you to believe that the planet's in trouble, because you're not. And so I think that people, you know, the bright greens have certainly got to the stage where they know exactly what the problem is. They have, you know, willful blindness, because the thought of actually giving up on electricity and civilization is just too much. Just the thought of saying that the whole civilization itself is not viable, and it's basically runs at a deficit. So everybody thinks that there's a surplus or some kind of dividend that comes from tech. And nobody, you know, I think you and Leah and Max are some of the few people that agree with me that there is no profit out of civilization. It actually runs at a deficit. But that's such a huge thought to people that they've been living since, you know, 10,000 years just in this fiction. But to overthrow that, you have to overthrow every great mind in the Western tradition. You have to overthrow science. You have to, you know, there's so much you have to throw out that you can see that I think a lot of people would rather die than go there.
Well, yes, I completely agree. And especially they would rather kill the planet than go there. And that's one of the things that I got from Lundy Bancroft's work about domestic violence perpetrators, is that, you know, the cliche is that addicts don't change until they hit bottom. And the problem with those who are addicted to their own entitlement at the cost of others is that they're not the ones who hit bottom. Everybody else does. They're doing fine, thank you very much. And so the problem is that insects are hitting bottom, and that freshwater mussels are hitting bottom, and that anadromous fish are hitting bottom, and poor humans are hitting bottom, but the rich humans, it's like we are literally living better than kings 500 years ago, 100 years ago, 200 years ago. You know, Roman emperors, I don't know if they had access to ice cream 24/7. They may have had access to iced goods 24/7, but they didn't have instantaneous communication. They didn't have rapid travel. You know, I don't know. I'm sure you've read William Catton's Overshoot. I don't remember the number of ghost slaves that we have. That he talks about ghost slaves are the amount of energy that we use if we were provided by human slaves. And I don't know what the number is. I'm making this up, so don't quote the number. But it's like each one of us has access to 490 slaves worth of energy.
Yeah, I thought it was about 600, for an American.
Underestimate than overestimate. So we have access to 600. Why would we want to give this up? And of course, Mumford talked about this as the Magnificent Bribe. But his question was, why have we all surrendered so easily to the system? And he said that the advantage of this system over the more, as he called them, half-baked autocratic systems of the past is that this one has made the promise of extending the goodies to at least a significant minority of the people. And this is one of the things that horrifies me, is that we are trading the world for access to ice cream 24/7 and to television programs and to, you know, whatever else. And admittedly, to modern medicine and to, you know, the things that actually do make our lives better, as well as just luxuries that literally no one could have dreamed of a while ago. And it kills me too. There's this great, I love the, I'm going to butcher it, but there was a title of a Doobie Brothers album that is What Were Once Vices Are Now Habits. And it's extraordinary how things that were complete luxuries, and I think I mentioned this last time, that there was a study done in the UK of people 18 to 25 or something like that, and given a choice between Wi-Fi and sunlight, they chose Wi-Fi. And, you know, you and I grew up without Wi-Fi, and we grew up without computers. And it's extraordinary how fast, you know, my mom was born before telephones were a big deal. They existed, but most people didn't have them. And if they did, it was party lines. And, you know, go back one more generation. So my mom's mom, my grandma, was probably born in like 1900-something. And I'm guessing they didn't have electricity when she was born. This is all just the briefest blip. And we presume that we can't live without it. I'm sorry, humans lived without it for a long, long time.
Yeah, my gran was born in 1900, and so yeah, she didn't have electricity because it was on a farm. So it was, you know, and most people had oil lamps and things like that. Technology has taken off tremendously in the last decades. I mean, in terms of, I can remember. My stepfather helped him build his yacht and sail his yacht. But in those days, nobody had all the electronics that are on a yacht today. And this is just the 80s. So, you know, you had an oil heater and you had oil lamps and stuff like that and gas. And now boats are just filled with gadgets and electronics. It's just unbelievable. If anything goes wrong, you need a computer technician to fix them. But there's a growing community of sailors that have tried to go retrograde and tried to, you know, get things that you can manufacture yourself. So you've got to put more wood in and you've got to, you know, learn traditional skills like celestial navigation and things that are dying out. And so there's kind of grassroots movement kind of prepping. And I'm kind of trying to get more in line with those guys. They're getting more minimalist, and you need very little to survive on a boat. In fact, on land too, but it's noticeable on a boat. So I'm trying to move in that direction. But yeah, I also live with solar, and all my water is made with a water maker from solar, and I had a wind generator, which I chucked away. I gave it away because it was useless. And so I know firsthand that we cannot run our civilization on solar. Just the expense of the batteries and how, you know, what you can actually do with batteries. You switch on a microwave oven, you cook the batteries in seconds. And nobody seems to realize that. They think we're all going to have batteries and then, you know, it's not going to be like they think it is. It's going to be like you say, where they're doing massive, you know, dam building programs to, you know, have hydropowered storage. And so there's a big con game going on within the con game of the bright green lies as well, right?
Yeah, I agree with that. And that was one of the things I love about being a writer is that I go into a book with some ideas, but I learn as much as readers learn through it. And I didn't know, for example, that like whatever it is, 95%, when they talk about grid level storage, they, you know, we hear a lot about lithium batteries, which are atrocities in themselves, but 95% of it is that pumped hydro storage, or 96 or 97, 93, somewhere in there. And I had no idea about that. In fact, when we wrote the book, it was 99%. It's just gone down a little bit in the last couple of years. And pumped hydro storage is simply you make two big dams and one of them's higher than the other, and you pump water up when you've got excess electricity, like when the wind's blowing and the sun's shining. And then when you need the electricity, you let it run back down. And I'm pretty horrified by the fact that we even have to discuss the ecological harm caused by dams. And there are a lot of pumped hydro storage, in other words, big dams, that are basically shovel ready, waiting for funding all over the world. And it's, you know, there was a line by Ozzie Zehner that I just love, which has to do with electric cars, which is generally environmentalists don't like electronics, and generally they don't like cars, but if you put them together and make an electric car, suddenly environmentalists are jumping up and down and saying this is great. And it's the same with this, that one of the things that has happened in my activist life, so in the past 30, 35 years, is that environmentalism has been so captured by the bright greens that dams used to be something to be unreservedly opposed. And now you actually have some environmental organizations that are in favor of dams because they've been captured so completely by this notion that we have to continue to power civilization. And another lie that just I didn't know going in, but it just kills me, is it's the whole Jevons paradox stuff, that basically every time you bring a new energy source on, you don't replace old ones, you just add on. So it became really clear to me early in the book that all of this stuff about we need to make all of this to stop global warming. I mean, it's not working at all. We can cover that more. But it's really a response more than anything to, A, the insatiable demands, the insatiable energy demands of this culture, and B, the fact that oil is finite. And so they need to get, my character is not to reach toward conspiracy theories, but instead toward historical forces, you know, sort of larger historical. It's not a cabal of six people who are deciding something. Instead, it's sort of the functionings of capitalism or the functionings of societies. The point is that it is a sociological response to the fact that we cannot question the insatiable energy demands and this recognition that oil is finite and there need to be more sources brought on, and these sources are incredibly expensive. And then combine that with Naomi Klein's brilliant understanding that, you know, her shock doctrine stuff about the way you get peoples to hand over tremendous amounts of money is by scaring them. And capitalism itself has used global warming, which is legitimately scary. It's terrifying. They've used that. Instead of actually to face the problem, they've used that to get trillions in subsidies for the additional energy sources. And again, this is not some sort of secret conspiracy. This is just how the system works. Is what I'm saying making any sense?
Yeah, I have a multi-million dollar friend, maybe a billionaire, and he's really far right. I mean, he's openly says he's a fascist. And generally I found this with conservatives on the far right is that they say, well, the whole of climate crisis and things like that is just a huge scheme by the left to wring money out of the government for all these schemes. And he's absolutely right. Biden's going to spend $1.9 trillion on a version of the Green New Deal, but it's just an economic stimulus package and giant industrialization program to compete with China. So he's absolutely right, but where they get it wrong is they assume that means that climate change is a hoax.
Exactly.
No, climate change is real, and they are abusing it for capitalists and industrial projects. So they are, you know, the right doesn't get that it's possible that the climate, you know, the environment is collapsing at the same time as these guys are trying to, you know, build the economy.
Yeah, I completely agree with everything you said. And also, just for the record, there's a sense in which I find it easier to deal with the people who are open fascists than the people who are sort of lefties who pretend to like the environment but then do great harm to it. I say that as somebody who has lived my adult life, in fact, almost all my life in the rural west of the United States, which has some very strong anti-environmental groups and very strong anti-environmental sentiments. And that can be really frustrating, but at the same time, there is something refreshing about sort of having somebody openly oppose you as opposed to taking some of your rhetoric and then turning it around for ends that are actually in opposition to you.
Well, talking about that, I think it's a good time to broach the subject of your AMA on the Collapse subreddit. So I don't know if you saw the upshot of it, but you've been kind of, all three of you have been disinvited from Collapse. They made huge apologies and they said they going to, you know, the moderators said that they're going to announce in advance who they get on an AMA so that they don't offend people. And of course, your big offense is, you know, is your perceived transphobia. And they also, I think a lot of people pegged Leah as a TERF. And so I got this strong impression from it. First of all, I don't know if you're familiar with the background to Collapse and the Collapse subreddit and if you know what they're about. But I think they are, it's difficult to tell their gender, but I think they are actually bright greens. And so I put a number of posts to Bright Green Lies and to Julia Barnes's movie, and they took it down. And then a lot of people protested, and then they kind of weaseled out and they kind of put it back up. But they tried to suppress the book and the movie on the Collapse subreddit. And then when I saw that AMA and saw the upshot of it, I thought that it was a hit job. I thought it was a deliberate hit job, just like they did to Roger Hallam. So Die Zeit did something very similar in Germany. They kind of completely trashed Roger Hallam and got him kicked out of XR. And they did it by just making a reference to the Holocaust. It was just completely out of context. And then they used that as a means to just bring him down. And I got the strong sense that that's what they did to you. I think that there were, you know, you got to be conspiratorial about this, because I don't know at what level this conspiracy comes in. But it seemed to be a direct hit on you guys, on just, you know, wokest agenda. But what do you have to, did you know about any of this in the aftermath of the AMA?
No, I don't. I've never been on Reddit, I mean, except for that. And I don't, I've gotten a few notes afterwards from people who were on there basically apologizing for what happened. And the whole thing was handled incredibly poorly. So for those who don't know anything about it, we were asked to ask me anything. We were asked on there, and they said, we will keep everything polite. And then they did, first off, a terrible moderation, because they were allowing in all sorts of insulting stuff. And it was ask me anything. So I took them at face value, and I responded to the insulting things seriously. I pretended I was too stupid to understand they were insulting, and then just answered the content. And then they took down my response to some of the stuff as being offensive and left up the insults, the original insults. And that's when I quit. I just said, sorry, I'm not going to participate anymore. This is crap. And then what I did is I went public with what happened, which is what I'm going to do every time this happens. And I've done this for a while now, that when I get deplatformed over these issues, I just go public with it. And it ends up being great, because I end up getting a lot more attention to all the issues than I would have just from the original thing. And there's a couple issues, and I don't know, we can either go the whole trans issue if you want or not. It doesn't matter. But
But I'd like to know first if you think it was a deliberate hit, because, you know, here you've got this great book. It's so emotional and so much passion in it from you and the other co-authors. And it got completely trashed, and I thought it's deliberate. It was a setup. I got the strong feeling that you were set up to detract from the message of Bright Green Lies, because they are bright greens on our Collapse. They just hide it.
Well, I will defer to you, because I don't know, like, I've never been there before. I just showed up to answer the questions, and it seems odd to me. Again, I'm not disagreeing with you, but it seems odd to me that you would have a Collapse forum that would be bright green, because collapse is really talking about collapse. It's not talking. It would seem to me that if I was going to make a collapse group, it would be, I mean, if any direction it went, it would be, what's it going to look like? It wouldn't be, let's build solar panels to actually make the ultimate crash worse. I mean, that just seems silly to me.
It's not so much the kind of what I call neon green, so it's kind of solar panels and wind farms. It's more like the communist thing, so the Gramsci's long march through the institutions. And so it's kind of celebrating the collapse of capitalism and the capitalist way. And the idea is that, you know, oh, China's brilliant and China's green. And so, you know, we will all be Chinese. And so it'll be a Chinese utopia now that China's, you know, world hegemon. So there are a lot of communists and stuff on our collapse from what I can see. If you track the users that make kind of really obvious kind of comments, you can look at their history and you can see where they're coming from.
Well, first, it's nonsense to say that China's communist. I mean, for crying out loud, it's just another form of capitalism. It's a different form of state-sponsored capitalism. It's just, that's not, I'm not agreeing with you.
I've always harbored a suspicion that they never gave up communism. They're just using state capitalism so that they can, you know, take over the world. And then they will implement communism.
Well, I don't actually think that's possible on an industrial scale in any case, because industrial production requires that resources be funneled toward the producers. And so you're always going to end up with what is either a managerial or an ownership class.
Yeah, but okay, now we have to get conspiratorial because we kind of got here. You know about Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum?
Oh, yeah.
So it's from what I can tell is Klaus Schwab is also communist. And they are industrialists. They're transhumanists, and they're thinking everything will be managed by AI. So they all kind of converge because you have a capitalist like Gates who thinks the same way. They all think that we're going to have this kind of managed utopia that's going to be managed by technocrats who will look after us in a paternalistic way. And all the problems will be solved by AI and tech. So every problem you come up with in Bright Green Lies will be solved by tech, according to them. And so that's why I mentioned last time that I really feel you should get onto your next book, and hopefully it'll be something against geoengineering. Because what's increasingly becoming obvious is they're going to do geoengineering to buy more time. And so I think it'll be an unmitigated disaster in the long run. But you can see how they all converge. None of them are, capitalism has ended. Everybody's a state capitalist now, and they're heading towards communism, especially, you know, Klaus Schwab says, you will own nothing and you will be happy, which is a longstanding, you know, utopian transhumanist and communist thing.
So I completely agree with you on the transhumanism. I agree with all of your analysis. I think, and not that this matters, but I think the only thing I would disagree with is, I don't know that I would call that communism. I think we are having, the only disagreement here is purely linguistic in what you call it, because I completely agree with every bit of that analysis. And it all is right in line with Lewis Mumford's understanding that the technics, the combo of technology and society, end up becoming authoritarian and end up running. I mean, that we end up serving the machines and serving the social machines as well. And it doesn't really matter. Kirkpatrick Sale, we quote Kirkpatrick Sale in Bright Green Lies about how these technologies are incredibly adaptable. It's sort of technocratic state. I don't remember what he calls it, but I think that might be it. The technocratic state is incredibly adaptable, and it can be adapted to a, quote, benign dictatorship like Singapore or an outright dictatorship like Saudi Arabia. It can be adapted to liberal Norway or conservative, you know, name some other country. And all these others are, all these other parts are, all these other economic and governing systems are really secondary to the technocratic control of society. And I think we'd agree on that.
Yeah, well, I mean, Marx was always an industrialist, and he always believed in the surplus, even though, you know, if you go back to ancient civilizations, and there was no surplus. They all ran at a deficit. That's why they're all ruins today.
Yeah.
But Marx was fundamentally an industrialist. So all of these agree. There's only the Greens and the anarchists that are oppose this industrial controlled society.
Right.
I don't think there's a benevolent form of it, because it's all extractive and it all just pushes us further into drawdown.
Completely agree with you. So there's one thing I want to go back to. We can go back to multiple things too, but I want to go back to one thing with your discussion of the collapse AMA that is one of the things that is destroying discourse and is, I think, frankly, horrific. And it's coming from the left. I don't know if the right does it or not. That is the Cootey's theory of politics, which is if anybody has any impure thought, if anybody disagrees with dogma at any point, then that person is not allowed to speak on any issues whatsoever. And there's this whole list of hot button topics about which, if you disagree, it kills me. Anarchists are supposed to be no gods, no masters. But honestly, a lot of anarchists hate me because I don't run everything I say past the Anarchist Central Committee before putting it out there. Or you could also say I don't get approval of the Anarchist Bishop Synod. And there's a whole bunch of these. Like, I interviewed this person earlier this year, Diana Johnstone. The interview I did with her, she's an old school lefty from, you know, she's in her late 80s now. And the question I asked her was, how has belonging to the EU become the left used to be against globalization, but now, if you are, for example, in favor of Brexit, you are a fascist. And I don't actually have a huge opinion on Brexit. I don't live there. All I know is most of my sort of lefty friends, if I even ask why, what's wrong with Brexit, they get really mad and call me a Nazi. And again, I'm not taking a position on that issue. And I hate the fact I even have to put that stupid disclaimer in. But that's one of them. There's a whole long list of issues that if you blaspheme on those issues, you now have cooties, and anybody who talks to you has cooties, and then they all get infected. And so we can't talk to anyone, even for 1 minute, who disagrees on those issues. And this I find completely horrifying. You know, I don't even agree with myself on every issue. There's plenty of things I've written in books that I don't agree with anymore. And this sort of rigid, I'm sure you and I don't agree on every issue, and I don't care. I couldn't give a shit. And so it's that I don't mind we can talk more about this or not if you want, but my
fundamental, I would like to talk about this. Yeah.
My fundamental belief on the whole trans issue is that humans are a sexually dimorphic species, and a little boy who likes to play with dolls and wear dresses should be loved precisely for who he is, which is a little boy who loves to play with dolls and wear dresses. And a little girl who likes to play football and work on cars should be loved precisely for who she is, which is a little girl who loves to work on cars and play football. And your clothes choices and your hobby choices don't override physical reality. And also, women should not be forced to share their most vulnerable spaces with males, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's all I said that they found was so offensive. And my real point is that I would have no problem if I was asked to do an Ask Me Anything on a forum about the trans issue, and then they got mad because I disagreed with them and kicked me off. But a collapse, I mean, it has nothing to do with the issue. So I would have no problem with with women getting mad at Ed Abbey if he's talking about issues of how women are treated in literature, because he didn't treat them well in literature. But if you're going to talk about environmental stuff, it's like Ed Abbey's Ed Abbey. And I don't, you know, I got interviewed a few months ago, and a bunch of lefties got really mad at me for this. A guy asked me for an interview, and I said yes, because I usually do. And then he said, right before the interview, he said, you know, you should know that I'm I don't know if it was a white separatist or something. And like, we did the interview anyway, and it was, his questions were actually really good. And when I disagreed with him, I would disagree with him. Like, one of his questions was, global warming is going to cause great migrations of people. So how will that affect, what do you think about that in terms of human migration? And he put in racial overtones on the question. I don't remember what they were. And I said, look, I'm going to say something's going to piss off the left and say something's going to piss off the right. The thing that's going to piss off the right is the reason a lot of these people are moving, the reason a lot of people move into these other countries is not because they don't like their lives. It's because capitalism has destroyed their land base. And the people from Guatemala who come to the United States, or from Mexico and come to the United States, it's not because they want to take an eco tour of the San Joaquin Valley. It's because their land has been taken so we can have coffee and bananas. And so they're moving. It's capitalism's fault at the center of empire. And then the thing that's going to piss off lefties is, I totally understand that if somebody's in a neighborhood and some new people come in, nobody likes that, no matter what race they are, no matter where they're from. I mean, this happens with bears. Some new bear comes in the neighborhood and everybody gets pissed at them. And if you have a community of 1,000 people and all of a sudden you have 1,000 new people come in, it doesn't matter if they're from New York City or from Guatemala, you're not going to like it, unless you're a developer, in which case you're an asshole. And a lot of people got really mad at me because I simply talked to the guy. My answers were perfectly fine. Nobody had a problem with them. But, oh my God, you talked to this guy. I got lots of hate letters from people saying, I can't believe you talked to this guy. It's like, whatever happened to talking to people we disagree with? I know this guy, Paul Cienfuegos, really great activist. He's been he's one of my heroes before I was even an activist. He's so fabulous. And he's been declared persona non grata in Portland in many ways, where he lives, because part of his work has involved going up to right wingers and saying, give me your perspective. Just tell me, I want to understand your perspective, so that we can see where we agree and disagree. And because he doesn't yell at them and tell them they're scum, then he has become persona non grata. And that's just insane. I mean, I've talked to loggers. I've had great conversations with loggers, and I've had great conversations, and we completely disagree on a lot of issues. But there's I won't tell this whole story because it's too long, but a short part of the story is I met this logger one time in completely non-environmental circumstances, and he my car had a flat tire, and he gave me a tire. And so then I go take him a cake to thank him for letting me use a tire to get home. And he says, what do you do? And I realize he's a logger. I like chainsaws all over his wall. And oh, no, no, actually, he'd asked me if I wanted some more firewood. So he's standing out in back holding a chainsaw as he says, what do you do? And I say, well, I'm a writer. He says, what do you write about? I'm like, oh, man. And I told him the truth because I'm not a very good liar. And I said, well, right now I'm working on a book about how the big four timber companies got their land illegally from the public domain. And he starts swearing and turns red in the face. And I'm looking for a break in the fence. And it takes me about 20 seconds to realize that he's an independent logger who was put out of business by Weyerhaeuser. And he hates the company even more than I do, which I didn't think was possible. Excuse me. So in another 20 seconds, we got our arms around each other's shoulders, swapping atrocity stories of how much we hate Plum Creek, all these timber companies. And then we agree that we're going to work together to take them down. And then I say to him, by the way, I'm against all forms of industrial logging. So after we take out Plum Creek, Potlatch, Boise Cascade, and Weyerhaeuser, I'm coming after you. And then we both just laughed our asses off because we both recognize that that's not going to happen in our lifetimes because our difference is really theoretical. And it's the same. You find, this is what politics is. You find people that you can agree with. Oh, another funny story. I was asked to do an interview. Publishers have sometimes set up interviews. And one time a publisher set up an interview that I don't know what they were thinking because it ended up being the Pittsburgh Pirates postgame show. It's a baseball postgame show. And I like baseball, but I had no idea going in. I just, called the number at the right time and then was put on. And both he and I are professionals. So it's like, I didn't know what to say about the game and he didn't know what to say about my book, but we needed to fill 15 minutes. So we started, we quickly, Western Pennsylvania, there's a lot of hunting. So what we both started talking about really quickly was how animal rights activists and hunters should work together to protect habitat. And then once the habitat's protected, the animal rights people can sabotage the hunts. And so I'm a big believer in making temporary alliances with whomever you have a temporary agreement with. And who cares what they think about other issues? And then when you, but you're honest with them. So you say, look, we disagree on this and this and this, and I will never agree with you on those issues. But we happen to agree. Oh, a great example is my sister. And then I'll stop rambling about this. One of my sisters is really right wing. And she was a city councilor on a small town in Virginia. And she and I would disagree on a lot of issues, but she was one of those honest to goodness conservatives who believes in local control. So she voted against a shopping mall coming into her community. I would have voted against it because I hate shopping malls. She voted against it because it was going to be put in by somebody from Washington, D.C. And so it was a distant person controlling their local economy, which annoyed the hell out of her. So if I would have been local, I would have really supported her on that issue. Okay, so now I'm done rambling. You can ask whatever you want.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you on all of that. And so, certainly on the trans stuff, I agree as well. Because we've been fragmented by identity politics, and everybody just grabs an identity and then defends it. And so and then you get these groups of LGBTQ, and then they kind of a block. And then if you're an environmentalist, then you get the label eco-fascist. If you're not a bright green and you think that, electric vehicles and solar panels, wind farms and stuff are going to harm the planet, well, then you're an eco-fascist. So there are all these scare words and labels. But I think exactly like you is that, forget all the labels and identities and just say, we're all human and we have proclivities and we have sexual preferences and it doesn't matter. It's just something you do. It's not something you are. But they've done a very good job, and I blame like Eddie Bernays and these guys that actually deliberately set this up, was to create identities so that basically we could be fragmented. I'm pretty down on that conspiracy theory because
I'm rolling my eyes because of exactly that. I have this sort of response against conspiracy theories, but the whole identity politics thing is so stupid and so destructive that I start to veer into the conspiracy theory stuff. That it's like it was built up to destroy class consciousness.
It was. Yeah. Well, yeah, go ahead, Tibby.
Oh yeah, I just said exactly. Yeah, the Eddie Bernays doing the perception management and giving us a consumer identity. Yeah, absolutely. And then what's going on with identity politics is everyone's going off in the silos and ossifying these identities and then knuckling down to defend them. And then it doesn't matter what kind of truth you throw at them. So it's really unhealthy. But the thing is that people need to realize is it is healthy to talk to people that have a different opinion than you, because you'll never grow if you don't. And then you come away from that and you self-reflect and you eventually detox from the bad ideas that you had or the untruths that you learned from all of this. Yeah. So it's just healthy.
Thank you for that. And a line I used to say quite a bit, which is true, is that I don't have any close friends with whom I have to revisit Civilization is Bad 101 every time I open my mouth. And that's true. I don't have any close friends. My closest friends aren't like that, but I talk to people otherwise. Like every Thursday, excuse me, I work with a guy who back when the Tea Party was a big deal, he was a member of the Tea Party. And years ago, when I was getting a whole bunch of death threats, I put up bars on my windows, and the person who helped me put up the bars on the windows was this guy, because he's a local friend. And, you know, it doesn't matter to me that he's Tea Party. So that's one thing. And the other thing that's pretty interesting is that probably about half of my books or half of the content of every book has come because I've talked with somebody I disagreed with. And they said, no, civilization can be sustainable. It can be made sustainable with such and such and such. And then I disagree with them in the moment, but I don't have answers to the specific issues they raise. And so I go obsess about this, or I go ruminate on it for 6 months, and I start to come up with answers. And that's how the entire book develops. I mean, the whole Bright Green Lies book developed because I was in a debate with a Bright Green. And so I think it's incredibly useful to talk to the people you disagree with, and to have them challenge you and say, that is not true. Civilization is not going to collapse. And so I have to prove it yet again. And I think that that's incredibly helpful.
Yeah, so we've been talking to guys on the libertarian right, and one guy in particular who's, you know, rapidly getting famous now because of the Wuhan lab thing. So he's a member of the team that exposed that, and the reason why Rand Paul and all this stuff has been going on is because of this team. So he's rapidly getting not notorious, actually famous. But the guys on the far right are very interesting because we can agree on stuff, and amazing amounts of stuff, but then it gets weird very quickly. So I'll give you an example, is that they climate deniers. And so we come up with arguments about, you know, basic mainstream climate science. And the weird thing is that they also think we're all doomed, but from solar flares, not from climate science. So it gets to be pretty interesting because you say, well, why are you worried about the climate? Because, you know, you might as well worry about asteroids or solar flares, which are going to come because of biblical prophecy. That's why it's going to come. And you say, well, it's anthropogenic. We can do something about climate change potentially, just as human beings. I mean, as individuals, no. But you know, it's very, I totally agree with you that we should make alliances of convenience, because they also against the, you know, Green New Deal and all these massive industrialization programs. They also believe in homesteading and prepping and stuff. And, you know, it's there's so many things that are congruent, but for the wrong reasons. They have the same agenda in mind, and certainly, you know, kind of revolutionary. But these are the kind of hard right guys that are kind of did the insurrection, right, in January the 6th. So, but you just look at the insurrection and you say, yeah, that's the right way to go. I was very disappointed. I'm like, tell you about the solutions that you had and the thing. A lot of them said, you know, the government must do something. So like, the government's the last thing that's going to do something about it. I think we really need to destroy all this decentralization before they start doing mammoth geoengineering projects and stuff. And the libertarians, they think exactly the same reason. They think the same thing for different reasons.
Well, I used to teach at Eastern Washington University in the 90s. I had one student one time who was a far right winger. And we used to have really interesting discussions. And basically where we came to is that he said, look, both you and I hate corporations and the government. And you, Derek, want to go after the corporations first and the government second. I, whatever his name was, want to go after the government first and the corporations second, and that's our main difference. And, you know, I don't know that I completely agree with that, but I don't know that I completely disagree with it either. I think it was an interesting, and we both agreed that they're both autocratic. We both agreed that neither one serves human beings or communities. Or another guy, pretty interesting. This guy was, the same guy actually, he was a former former sawmill owner who'd been put out of business by Weyerhaeuser. And, he and I would get into big disagreements about logging. And one place we came to an agreement is we agreed, and this relates back to the thing with my sister, we agreed that no one should be allowed to clear cut more than, let's say, a half a mile or a quarter mile from their home and their water source. So somebody who lives in Canada cannot deforest in Washington. Somebody who lives in Washington can't deforest in the Amazon. And I don't think you should be able to deforest anywhere, but, and this is a start. We both agreed on absentee ownership is an absolute disaster.
Well, can I present this idea to you? So I think the way things are coming down more and more, I mean, the way it was up until fairly recently was climate deniers against, you know, climate catastrophists and climate alarmists, what they call them. But I think that the battle lines have changed. I saw in that rich friend that I mentioned, he used to be a rampant climate denier. And in the last couple of years, he stopped climate denial. Now he's kind of, he doesn't talk about it anymore. He used to campaign against it. And it's clear that everybody's a little bit scared because there have been one or two headlines that have been a bit scary. And so they will admit that this, you know, what I'm trying to say is climate denial is kind of passe. And where the new battle lines, I think, are drawing is this idea of the transhumanists, the centralized control, and essentially the eugenicists. There's no other word for it. And just this technical, nerdy, you know, the singularity of the nerds, the rapture of the nerds and stuff is what they think is going to happen. And that's one side. And then the other side, which cuts right down the middle of the old divide, is people like us that are for the living planet and for living organisms and against industrialization and this kind of macabre obsession with killing things off and making a market out of them. And so it's kind of like I would call like team human against the transhumanists. And the, you know, if you look at Naomi Klein and stuff saying that the polar bear doesn't do it for her, she's on the wrong side of the bench. She's a transhumanist. And she wants technical solutions and this kind of One Health, you know, this huge initiative really from the United Nations and things like that, and WEF and all these NGOs, and really kind of easy to be conspiratorial guys. You'd be conspiratorial about these guys. But these billionaires, the green billionaires, like Gates, Musk, even a little bit, but, you know, Klaus Schwab and that, their idea of environmentalism is, it's kind of a, you've got to imagine it as kind of a park, and it's kind of reserved, it's managed. Ecology is definitely a managed thing. And then there's, I see the, our team as being, you know, you've got to get the management out of things. You've got to stop this narrative of control and management and supervision of nature and just accept that we're subordinate to nature. And so I think that that's the new divide. What do you think about that idea?
I like it. I agree with it. I like it a lot. And the hesitation in my voice is not with the idea. The hesitation in the voice is that I think you are more articulate about it than probably many of the people who are on the other side of the fence. I know that there is the extreme transhumanist who claim that. I would guess that Naomi Klein would disagree with you that she's a transhumanist.
But she's an industrialist, right? She's an engineer.
Yeah. De facto, she is on the side of engineering and management and honestly colonialism, because you have to be. I mean, that's one of the things that killed me about this Changes Everything, is that she talked about how she talked about being strongly anti-colonialist, but you can't make solar panels in your backyard. I mean, they are a product of empire. And she's really excited because the price of solar panels has gone down so much. And the reason it's gone down so much is because they all moved from Germany to China. And in China, they use slave labor and they dump the stuff out in the open. They dump the pollution out in the open. And that's why the price has gone down, or major reason the price has gone down. And so, yes, I agree with you. And the difficulty comes that it is up to people like you and me to articulate this, because I think many of the people on the industrialist side, well, I think you're right. They would recognize that they are pro-industry, and they would say that they are. That's part of the problem, is that this culture has been able to make it so people can more easily envision the end of life on the planet than they can the end of this culture. And when you say, I want this culture to end, a criticism I get all the time is, oh, you want life to end. It's like, no, actually, I want life to continue. And they'll say, you want humans to all die. It's like, no, the way we're going is going to be much worse than, I mean, if we continue every day, drawdown is making it so the carrying capacity for humans, even if you don't care about anybody else, every day drawdown is making it so the carrying capacity of this planet for humans is lower than it was the day before. And so if you care, I mean, I write for non-humans, I write for prairie dogs and salmon, but I also write for the humans who will be here in 100 years, if anybody's here in 100 years. And I know in my bones that humans 100 and 150 years from now will vastly prefer your and my perspective than they will the bright green perspective, because our perspective at least gives the slightest chance of a livable planet. I don't give it a really good chance, but it gives the slightest chance. And the way forward gives no chance at all.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think the what's dangerous with people like Naomi Klein and stuff is they have identified this culture as life instead of identifying with life itself. So they think machines and markets and stores and governments are life, and no, these are artificial aberrations. They're superfluous to humans, like you've said, Hugh.
Yeah, I get a lot, you know, like, you know, you're against everything. And I'm not against everything. I'm just against the things that you were talking about. It's that they think this culture is everything. And so I'm for the oceans. I'm for the skies and the fish and the birds and stuff. And it's like, well, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I'm for everything.
Yep.
And they're against everything. But because their world is so narrow and just about industrialized civilization, they think I'm negative about everything. No, just industrial civilization. It just happens to be your entire world, but that doesn't mean I'm partial. You know?
Well, yeah, and, think about somebody who is addicted to heroin, and you're against that addiction to heroin, and they say, man, you're against everything in the world. It's like, no, I'm against your addiction that's killing you. Sorry,
yeah, that's where it comes down is to life. That's why I come down to is basically it's a life or death situation, because the transhumanists are really romancing death. I think that the psychology of even the rapture of the nerds is really a craving for death. They are actually necrophilia.
Yep, absolutely agree with you. Another thing, we don't have to go back. We don't have to dwell on this, but it blows me away what you said earlier about that collapse Reddit group, that I would think that a collapse Reddit group would be having the discussion that we're having right now, as opposed to, I mean, it blows me away that you said they're bright green. Again, I have no knowledge. I showed up for my thing and I left, and I've never been there before or since, but it blows me away that a collapse group, that makes cognitive dissonance for me. You would think a collapse group would be actually about collapse, and the furthest that I could grant them would be that they would want some sort of managed collapse.
Yeah, they want an alternative world. So you have to imagine it as the Gen Z and the youth, particularly in Extinction Rebellion, and they left wing, and they're all about identity politics and climate justice and veganism. So when they say, you know, they're like saying, what are signs of collapse in your neck of the woods, is they really gloating on the fact that this system doesn't work. And if you want to have huge upvotes, you put some disaster porn stuff up there that just says, you know, this system is finished. And then they're all glorifying it because they're depressed and they don't think they have a future in this system.
Well, but it sounds like what you're saying is when this system, they're specifically meaning capitalism, as we understand, or Western capitalism, however we want to say it, as opposed to the system being the totality of the system.
Yeah, they're not anti-civ in a big way. Some of them are anti-civ. There are quite a few anarchists and anarcho-primitivists on it. But they're not particularly primitivist. So I think if you kind of imagine Ocasio-Cortez's kind of vision, that it's all it's kind of a childish vision. We're all friends. It's all peaceful. We get rid of all the fascists. And we all, you know, it's all love and justice and listening.
Except fascists includes everybody who disagrees with this. So it's all love except for anybody who disagrees with this.
It's complete hypocrisy, because in what we've discovered talking to these libertarian right guys is I kind of knew it before, but all the prejudice and hate is actually on the left. All the guys that are about anti-hate and, you know, they are the ones that would like to, it's kind of like, you know, you better stop hating or I'll scratch your eyes out. It's kind of like, it's hypocrisy. But it's the biggest resistance to talking about to the libertarian left, and the libertarian left are quite ecological. I mean, the libertarian right is quite, they're quite a lot of ecologists. But even though they might shoot some of the wild, but they kind of like the idea of the wild and kind of Daniel Boone-ish, but still, you know, like you're saying with a logger, you can have a bit of meeting of minds with a hunter or fisherman or something like sportsman like that. They're worried that there will be no wilderness left and it'll be taken over by the woke crowd who has this kind of childish idea. But they're very open to talking to the left. The libertarian right is very open to talking to the left. They're not prejudiced. But the left, they virulently hate us. So you, unless you just check every box and you failed miserably on the trans one, and so do I. But, you have to have this idea that, I mean, it's patronizing. You have to say that it's toxic masculinity and, you know, it's the global, there's this romanticization of indigenous people and we can all learn from the global south. And it's poppycock. I come from the global south. I got to tell you, the only lesson you can learn from the global south is like, leave the global south alone. there's only one lesson you can learn from the global south is unplug the global north. But it's kind of like we can all have everything. They spoiled. And so where we've got to with the left, it's kind of where you get to with these liberal, elites, very, very privileged. And all the ideology is an ideology of privilege. And so I say to like this guy on the libertarian right is like, you know, why do you get so upset about wokeism? I don't think it's got much future because we're heading for trouble. I mean, we're heading for financial trouble. We're heading for ecological trouble. There's big social problems imminent. And so I say there's nobody's woke in a foxhole. So all of this is going to dry up and disappear with, as soon as the going gets tough. And I think the going is going to get tough very shortly.
So I want to tell a story from an interview I did back in the 90s. I interviewed this guy, Joel Dyer, who wrote a book called Harvest of Rage. And his book was about how so many, during the farm crisis, which is ongoing, where farmers were losing their land, why so many of them were becoming militant right-wingers and joining militia groups. And he said that he was, at the time, a hippie, and he had hair down to his butt, and he had an earring, and he rode into these small farming towns on his motorcycle, and he would go to the cafe where the farmers would be, you know, at 6 in the morning before they go do their chores. And he said that they might look at him weird for like 3 seconds, and then as soon as he said, tell me about what's going on your farm, they didn't care about him being a hippie. They didn't care about him wearing earring. Didn't care about his hair. And what he said is the problem, the reason so many of them were going to the right is because the left was doing a terrible job. And the reason the left was doing a terrible job is he said, so if you got some guy whose family is left and he's losing the land that his family has been on for 100 years, 200 years, 150 years, and he's sitting there with an empty bottle of Jack Daniels and a shotgun in his lap wondering whether to put it in his mouth, and somebody knocks on the door and says, let's talk about your troubles. He said, if that person is a right-wing militia person, that farmer is going to become right-wing militia. If they're a Mormon, they're going to become a Mormon. If they are a lefty, they would become a lefty. And the problem is that the left was not interested in reaching out to the farmers. And, you know, I heard, and I'm not defending anything he did. I heard some early talks or early things that Timothy McVeigh said about the U.S. military, U.S. imperialism, and man, they would not have been out of place in a Noam Chomsky talk. He was against imperialism, and I was thinking as I was watching this documentary about him, man, the left completely blew it. I mean, if a lefty would have reached out to Timothy McVeigh at some point, he could have been a really good anti-war veteran who could have spoken. He did speak articulately in an articulate fashion about the problems with U.S. military being policemen of the world. And that's not who he got in with. And So my point on this is just that this is not a new problem at all. This is a problem with the left for at least 30 years of completely ignoring huge sectors. I mean, this is a bit specific to the United States, but it horrifies me that the left, that at one point pretended at least to be about labor, now calls blue collar workers deplorables. That horrified me when Hillary Clinton said that. It's like that, yes, you may disagree with them on many issues, but man, that's, I can't imagine 80 years ago or 100 years ago, a member of the IWW calling a working class person a deplorable.
Well, look at Michael Moore, and I was horrified during the insurrection because across the board, as far as I could see it, the radical left, what was supposed to be the radical left, were making all these statements. How dare they come into our Congress and our seat of government and trash it and say, like, you know, your left wing in the 60s, that was the left wing dream, was to trample through Congress. And now they're finally getting all these people riled up and stamping on Congress. These guys have come full circle. They're conservatives, you know, wringing their hands about the democratic institutions being being undermined. It's come full circle.
And Michael Moore famously said, I believe in the 90s, that the Michigan militia was the unemployed arm of the UAW. So I'm going to have to go in a few minutes. Do you want to ask me a wind down question?
Well, okay, so since we got to this point, then maybe we can just end on this one thing, and we're late in the video, so it's a good place to do it because of the bots and, you know, that kind of thing. But anyway, I think one of the deficits on the left, if you're talking about these shortcomings, is, you know, going full spectrum, because another one of these blind spots is the days of the militant left are kind of gone, and there's this pacifism, extreme pacifism. And they will not do full spectrum. But on the right, they have no problem with that. And so in terms of where I think you and I agree on is that we, you know, it's time for radical action. And so, you know, the right is ready for that. They're itching for it. And the left has gone all weak at the knees and is extremely Gundy and MLK and taking all the wrong lessons for the crisis that we face.
So is that accurate? Because I'm thinking about BLM and Antifa riots in the United States, and unfortunately, they were based a lot on identity politics.
Yeah, the identity politics. You see, if you look at Antifa. They'll punch out a Nazi, but you don't see black blocs and things anymore.
I think, okay, I'm not a huge fan of Antifa, in part because they threatened to kill me and everybody I know, and over the trans issue primarily, and also because I disagree with some other things that they do. And it's really, I don't mind saying this, it's really a cult. In that anybody who disagrees with anything about them is, and it's okay. I've had some really interesting conversations with Chris Hedges, and I really like Chris Hedges a lot. And he and I disagree some on pacifism, in part because he's been a war correspondent. It's very interesting. He's been a war correspondent, and his lesson from violence is that it destroys people. And he has seen a lot of his friends die, and he basically has combat fatigue. And I respect it. I respect his positions. I respect him. It's all great. And he and I have interesting conversations. And he respects me too. And my experience of violence was my violent childhood. And what I took from my violent childhood is that abusers are insatiable. And that this culture, expanded to the large scale, this culture will not stop of its own, and we need to stop it. That it will continue to come up with excuses to destroy the planet. And so, and I don't think he disagrees with that either. And a place that he and I completely agree with on this is that a lot of people who perpetrate violence or who are willing to perpetrate violence often do so for the wrong reasons, because it's often, and I'm thinking of you, Antifa, it's often because they have some emotional issues they need to work out, as opposed to, which is why you can rationalize, or they can rationalize, burning a mom and pop store, as opposed to, or just random burning, as opposed to, as you were saying earlier, attacking the halls of power. You know, I have no problem with militant resistance as long as it's tactical, strategic, and moral. And I do have large problems with militant resistance that is not tactical, strategic, and moral. So I've seen, like, so I wish, here's what I really wish about violence. I wish that we could have, and maybe we should do this sometime, I wish we could have serious, principled, open, honest, which includes talking about our concerns too, conversations about when it is or is not appropriate to act, to have militant acts of resistance.
Yeah, I think that would be so good to do. So just from my point of view, I come from exactly both Chris Hedges and your world. I was an abused child, and then I got to see all the violence in South Africa. So what's my conclusion is exactly the same as you, is these guys are psychopathic and they're implacable. And then my experience in South Africa also shows me just exactly how it is required. It's basically that this doesn't end nicely. So it's if you, nobody craves violence. I agree with you in the Antifa thing. It's, there is some minor case for having some, you know, therapy for, you know, it's kind of aggression therapy to kind of get it out of your system. And it is good to do that, but you can do that in a much smaller scale with monkey wrenching and stuff like that. Just small scale sabotage. You don't have to really go full on, crazy about it. But I agree that there's a certain point you get to where you have to say, we understand the landscape. And the requirements of the landscape are exactly where the ANC got to. The ANC split, because they got to this point. They said, the ANC started in about 1901, and by our Sharpeville, 60 years, they said, like, we've been at this 60 years, and we know what it's going to take to budget. And they were right, to make it budge, right? And they were absolutely right. It took the magic kryptonite. And the kryptonite is very, very powerful stuff. And so there's no ways that this situation is going to resolve itself in time, given the pace of the ecological destruction. So I think we should have that conversation, because I don't see anybody having it. And I'm sure we can have it in such a way that it's, you know, aspirational, not operational, so that basically you wouldn't get us into too much trouble having it. But I really would like to do that one next if we could.
Okay, that sounds great.
Well, thank you so much again for being on. Yeah,
thank you very much, Derek.
Very nice to talk to you.
Yeah, appreciate your being here.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for your great questions and the great conversation.
And thank you for your book and all your work in the world.
Thanks. You too.
Really enjoyed it.
Thanks.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.